Hello, and welcome to Hired the Podcast. I'm Travis Miller. Today we are going to be joined by Rebecca Pay, founder of Pay for Precision, creating kick-ass CVs to get you interviews, and a brand new author. We're going to talk a lot about her book that's going to be released here in the next week or so. We spend a lot of time talking about what candidates can do to position themselves to really land the ideal position for them that they deserve to be as successful as they truly want. We talk a little bit about companies and what they can do to make sure that they're finding the people who have that most potential to be incredibly successful in their organization and achieve things for them that they never could have thought possible. And then we finish talking a little bit about LinkedIn, your LinkedIn game, your personal branding, and what you can do to really ensure that you're setting yourself up for that ideal position whenever it is right for you to go out and find that ideal position. Sit back, relax. Here we go.
Here I go, ready now. I'm coming for you. Can't nothing stop me. I got some things I gotta do. Hey, I'm making a move.
Well, here we are, Rebecca Pay on Hired the Podcast. Thank you for joining us today. I'd like to introduce everyone to Rebecca, founder of Pay for Precision, creating kick-ass CVs to get you interviews, and author of the soon-to-be-released book, How to Get the Kick-Ass Career You Deserve. Rebecca, thanks so much for being here with us today. Really appreciate it.
Thanks for having me. It's an honor.
Oh, get out of here. It's our pleasure. Rebecca, do me a favor. Just tell us a little bit about yourself and kind of what brought you here to this show today.
Okay, well, I'm here because you asked me. Although I don't always do what I'm told, to be fair. I've established my business on LinkedIn over the last couple of years. I mean, I've been running my business for 7.5 years. But I've kind of moved into CVs in the last couple of years, and so LinkedIn was obviously the place to be. And I think a couple of years ago is when it started to develop into more an interesting space to be as well. And obviously content creation has become huge on there. And I've, you know, managed to establish quite a nice network on there. I've got 21,000 followers now, I think. And apparently people are interested in me rambling on about things like me doing aerial hoop and pole and talking about my children or me roller skating on Tuesday. But obviously I do give away some good valuable stuff on CVs and career changes and things like that as well.
Well, you're giving away a lot of good stuff these days, and you got to be excited. New book comes out in what, week, 2 weeks?
I know, yeah, it's really exciting. I'm actually hoping to get the kind of finished copy online, a virtual copy kind of thing, an ebook back today, and then it'll be ready to kind of be uploaded and stuff in good time for next week, hopefully. So hopefully I can get like an actual physical copy as well for the launch, because the launch is on the 17th, so hopefully I'll be able to actually have a book in my hands that I've written, which will be going to be really, really weird, I think. Well, I mean, it's, yeah, it's super exciting, but it's also quite surreal and also a little bit scary, Travis, because people are going to be reading a book that I've written and they might actually think it's rubbish.
I doubt that, but so why isn't it rubbish? The title sums up the book pretty nicely, How to Get the Kick-Ass Career You Deserve, but who really is the target audience, and what can people expect when they pick up the book?
Okay, well, it's written very much the same way I speak. So I think people who enjoy my content and stuff on LinkedIn would enjoy it anyway. And you know, it's a very easy to read style, so it's not very formal or whatever. It's easy to kind of use and pick up and read a bit book and then put it down kind of thing. But the idea is it's a mix. So it's a practical guide of how to actually create a CV and how to use LinkedIn to find a job and to find opportunities. There's some really good practical advice, like literally kind of lay your CV out like this, mm-hmm. Do the skills section like this kind of stuff. Because sometimes you do just want to know how to do it. But also, you know, we do kind of dig into if you're making a career change, what else does that involve? Like, what are the thought processes? Like, how do you work out what you actually do want to do? Uh-huh. Like, you know, looking at jobs that you've liked before and ones that you've disliked and why? And then also, if you once you make up your mind, how do you get there? Like, how do you plan out what you're going to do? And also then the kind of mindset shift that you need to make to do that, because it's not, you know, big changes are difficult for us. Humans, we don't like change generally. And you have to kind of be in the right headspace to be able to deal with it, because if you are making, say, a career change or even a step up, you know, to a managerial role or whatever it is, you're going to have to kind of feel a bit uncomfortable for some of that. And so I do kind of address that side of it as well, a kind of mindset side of it, because I think that's really important. I'm quite, you know, pro looking after yourself and the self-care side of it and doing other things apart from work. But we do spend a lot of time working. So the more ideal the job is for you, the better.
It's one of the hardest changes people can make. I experienced it, you know, secondhand a couple of years ago. My wife was a teacher, high school PE teacher for 11 years. And not from the moment that we met, our anniversary is actually this weekend, 7 years ago. But pretty quickly after we met, she started to get more and more disillusioned with the career. And to the point the last 2 or 3 years there, she just hated it. I mean, going to work was a dread for her. And we were fortunate enough that we were in a position where we were able to take the financial hit of her losing her salary for 2 years to go back to school to start an entirely new career. And she started that career about 6 months ago, and she could not be happier with the path her life has taken now. But it was a huge, huge decision. And, you know, it was I think the hardest part was having that realization that she was not stuck. She could take this very big step and make a change. And I think that's probably the hardest piece for a lot of people, is realizing that, having that feeling that they are stuck and realizing that they're not stuck.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you have to remember that everything's a choice. And you're definitely not trapped. Whatever situation you're in, it might feel very much like you are trapped. You know, we've all kind of had that feeling sometimes. But whatever you're doing and why you're there, it's all a series of choices you've made. And therefore, to get somewhere else, if you're not happy with where you are, you need to make different choices to get out of that. And I kind of do address that quite a lot in the book, because, you know, sometimes people can be like, oh, but I've got to live here because, you know, I'm looking after my mom who's ill or whatever it is. But then you're still choosing to do that. You know, it's not kind of like forced on you. It's still a choice. You know, even looking after children and stuff is a choice. So I'm not suggesting people ditch their children or ill mothers and run off and go and do something crazy. But I'm just saying, the more you recognize that you've chosen to do those things, it's a better feeling for you than feeling like, oh God, I'm trapped in this life I don't want to be in. And so look at the things you can, you know, that you do want to change. And then, like, for your wife to make that huge decision to have to study again is massive. But obviously the payout is huge. It's like a short-term pain for a long-term gain, basically, isn't it?
And I know it's hard for a lot of people out there, because there are family commitments, there are financial commitments, but I don't want to say there's always a way, because I'm not in everybody's shoes, but I think most of the time there is a way for that temporary pain, temporary discomfort, for that long-term growth and happiness that is achievable if you are lucky enough to end up finding something that you love doing and you're passionate about achieving with your career.
Yeah, definitely. I think sometimes you do have to just make a leap with it, you know. I mean, I know people that have taken their kids around the world and, you know, worked remotely or whatever and taken their kids around the world for a year or something, because that's something they really want to do. And I mean, what? And a lot of people be like, "Oh God, I can't do that. I can't take them out of school." But it's like they will benefit far more from going out of school for a year, you know, by going around the world and learning lots of different things. You know, it's an example of something we'd be like, "Oh, I can't do that," but actually, you could do it if you really, really wanted to. You definitely can do it. And so there's that. You know, those examples are myriad. Really, there's loads of situations where I think we just put blocks in our own way so much of the time.
So if somebody does, they're able to have that realization that they're not stuck, and they are in a career that they are not excited about, they're not passionate about, what are the first steps they can take to start to find and identify something that will make them happy, that will reignite the passion for the work they're doing?
That's when you need to start thinking about what you've liked doing previously, because often when you look back to an old role, it's not necessarily the job you were doing day to day. It's quite often the maybe the culture you're in, the environment, the other people, maybe the autonomy you had, all those sorts of things. Kind of be honest with yourself about that stuff, and also kind of what's your legacy going to be like? What are your kind of core values? Because mate, you might be working somewhere where it's really kind of going against some of your core values when it comes down to it. You know, not every business is run in the most ethical way or whatever. That might be something that's really important to you. So when you start looking at those kind of values for yourself, then you can find somewhere that aligns with that a bit more. And it doesn't necessarily mean run off and work for a charity. It might do, which is fine, but it's not necessarily about, you know, oh god, you know, I have to take a massive pay cut and do this, that and the other. You can still work in a, you know, a well-paid corporate job, but it might be for a different corporation that treats their, you know, their people differently, and it might be that they've got a better scheme for, you know, employing diverse people, or, you know, they put loads of money back into the community, or what they're actually doing is making more of a difference. Because mm-hmm. all those things obviously feed into how you feel about your role and how you feel about your job. And once you know what you kind of need to get out of it, then you can start looking for the right fit somewhere.
Uh-huh. What's your story? Because I would imagine that you didn't set out when you were a wee lass to be an author and to run a consulting firm helping people get the career that they're excited and passionate about. How did you end up identifying your why, understanding what you were passionate about that led you to do this thing that you're doing now?
That's a good question. I've done loads of different jobs, actually, and I think more than anything, it was kind of a lack of understanding of myself. Like, you know, we all have it when you're growing up and stuff, you don't really understand yourself necessarily that well. I'm the kind of person that's really good at whatever I do, so I've done loads of different types of career, and always done really, really well, but then never really got promoted and never got into like managerial like roles. So then I've ended up getting bored and moving on to something else. And I always get on really, really well with all the clients, but the managers and stuff don't generally like me because I'm too outspoken. And I'll call out like rubbish. Like if I see it happening, I'm like, no, I can't stand for this. And I'll stand up for other people and stuff. And obviously, you know, managers don't want that kind of person on their team usually. And so I was never trusted with the kind of like supervisory role really. And so you get bored then, and then you move on to something else. But obviously that's given me a lot of insight into loads of different careers and different types of people. I mean, when I was 20, I was homeless and I lived in the YMCA for a bit. And that's, you know, life experiences like that are huge. Mm-hmm. And that in itself was a big turning point for me. That's when I got my first proper job, really, because I was like, well, I've got to do something now because it's just me now. It's down to me now. I can't live here. This is terrible. So I went and kind of marched down, got my one suit on, marched down, like walked 2 miles, I think it was, to a TGI Fridays and got a job working on the door there for them and like coordinating the restaurant and stuff. It's actually a really fun job. But kind of that got me into like different roles and into sales and telesales and then recruitment and then council and advertising and loads of different stuff. And I've done education as well and teaching. But I mean, me falling into having a business was more from a choice of like a life choice of wanting to look after my daughter when she was a baby. Because uh-huh. I didn't want to go back to a 9-to-5 type role or working in a school as I was doing at the time. It's like, I don't want to leave my baby and pay someone else to look after them. That's not why I've had children. This is, you know, that felt horrible for me. Mm. Like, you know, I'm not knocking anyone who does that, by the way, but for me, it just wasn't going to be working. And so I had a friend who had set up a business doing a sort of similar thing, doing copywriting and proofreading. And I was like, oh, I can do proofreading. I learned proofreading when I worked in advertising, and I've written copy and done copywriting courses and stuff. Okay, let's have a look at this. And just started really small. And it was just kind of like a bit of extra money, just enough to be able to stay at home with my daughter. Then went on to have my son, grew up, like they started to grow up a bit more, give me a bit more time. So I was able to expand the business a bit more. And kind of, I love moving into CVs because I love helping people. Mm-hmm. And that kind of the magic kind of moments you get where people just kind of suddenly realize they're actually really good. God, and like, and they get their confidence back, because a lot of people have kind of lost their confidence. They've been kind of dragged down either by a bad job, or they've been made redundant or whatever, and they just kind of lost that belief in themselves. And what I offer is so much more than just a CV service, because I know after having spoken to clients, it's like, but you've changed how I feel about myself now. And I'm like, but I haven't really done anything. I've just, you know, spoken to you, and now you've, you know, looked at all your skills and experience, and you've realized that you're actually really kick ass. That's why you need a kick ass CV to go with it.
So you need to add therapist to your CV. And that's what a good therapist does. They let them come up with the answer.
Yeah,
and people get, I think, job seekers can get beaten down because they're applying, and they're not hearing anything back, or getting the wrote form letters that their resume got bounced by the applicant tracking system. And, you know, they come to you in hopes of that you can help them write the perfect CV, the perfect resume. But you make a point in your book that there is no such thing as a perfect CV. But how do you help people make it as close to perfect as it can be for the position that they're hoping to get?
Yeah, I mean, you're right. There's definitely no perfect CV. It's a, you know, it's a very subjective kind of view. And you'll actually find, you know, you'll get a CV created that might be, you know, good enough, but actually someone else will say, oh no, that's not very good. And like, you know, people have different opinions on it. But how you rate a CV is whether it gets you the interviews for the jobs you want. Mm-hmm. It's as simple as that. So if it's getting you the interviews for the jobs you definitely want, then that's, you know, that's good enough, isn't it? But one of the main things I think with a CV that people are maybe a bit scared to do as well, is not just about keeping it simple for the applicant tracking system and all that kind of, like, you know, almost basic stuff, which you can get right. It's putting your personality in there and making it individual to you, because it's so easy to kind of like Google and cut and paste something in about, I don't know, a marketing manager role, say, whatever, and a description of a marketing manager, and these are the skills I need, so I need to describe myself like this, which is fine to an extent because you want to get the keywords in that are on the job description. But does that tell us anything about you or how you approach the role, or, you know, what kind of marketing that you particularly like, or why you're doing it, and, or, you know, what the impact is that you've had on roles in the past, and why you're going to be better at this than anyone else? Those are the kind of things that you want to get across, because that's how a CV stands out, is from having really good content, not having, like, you know, a fantasy border or whatever else.
It seems to, it's such a fine line to walk, and unfortunately, really hard to get right. I see so many resumes that are not enough. They are that copy, cut, paste of the just boilerplate list of the jobs people have done. It's just a listing of the job descriptions that they've done. And then I see a bunch that are too far on the other side. It's like, unless you're applying for a job in graphic design, your resume should not look like this.
So true.
But there's not enough in the middle that are people highlighting the experiences that they've had that have truly set them apart. And what are some strategies and tactics that people can do to really highlight who they are, what they've accomplished, what makes them special?
I think it can be hard. I think writing about yourself is really hard. So I think it's good to recognize that. Like, don't expect to be able to be really good at it. So I'd say that's probably one of the things that people struggle with the most, is writing that initial kind of opening profile statement, which is the bit you want to get really good. But I think having a big brainstorm about it is really important. Get loads of words written down as a starting point. Ask colleagues, ask friends, people that know you, like a partner even, and definitely like managers or maybe ex-managers, people that you got on with, preferably, or people that you've managed as well, like if you're a lead in a leadership role, and find out what they think about you and how they would describe you. Because I think getting all that feedback is really valuable. It's often quite a good insight into things about you that you wouldn't necessarily think yourself, or you don't always realize yourself, especially leadership roles. People hear back what people have said about, you know, what type of manager and how they see them. It's like quite surprising for some people, and it's like they've had quite a big impact on people's like working life without always realizing it. And you know, look back at old appraisals and stuff like that, what's been said about you before, and kind of gather all that intel together, along with your own kind of brainstorm, and then just get something down on paper, just make a start on it, and get it out of your head, and then start refining it and editing it. And you know, obviously get someone else to read it after you've done it as well.
What are some of the biggest mistakes that you see people making in their resumes?
I would say typos is quite big, which sounds kind of such a like a minor thing, but it's such a simple fix. And although obviously, you know, you might have someone who's dyslexic and they're going for a role, it doesn't matter if they can spell, you know, that's not part of the role. But even if you know that about yourself, that you're rubbish at spelling or whatever, then you're going to surely get someone to check it for you. So there is no excuse. Do you know what I mean? It's not about not being inclusive of people that have got difficulty with those things. That's going to be part of your job role, probably, to recognize where you've got a weakness or you need help and you go and ask someone. So it's not a bad thing to ask for help from someone. That's, you know, that's showing insight into what, you know, what your strengths and weaknesses are. Also, I'd say people put way too much information in often, like way too much detail. Like, great, put some achievements in, but we don't need to know every detail of the project or whatever, because firstly, no one's going to read it. Secondly, you're just overloading people with information they don't want. You know, it's have a nice highlight of the achievement and kind of whet their appetite and make them think, oh God, that's impressive. How on earth did they do that? And then that's something they can ask you about then in the interview. Like, well, how did you achieve that massive like sales target or whatever?
Well, you said it earlier. A successful resume is a resume that gets you interviews. A successful resume is not a resume that gets you the job.
Absolutely. Absolutely. You know, you've got to do that bit of work yourself. I can't do that.
A trick I learned a while ago as somebody that does have a touch of dyslexia, and spelling would certainly not be described as one of my fortes, is anytime I'm about to publish something, I read it out loud, and it forces my brain to concentrate on the words, and I'm much better at spotting those little typos if I'm reading it out loud.
Yeah, I mean, it's one of my big tips that I always have for any kind of proofreading, like for any content, is reading it out loud. And also, there's no excuse now. Microsoft Word has an read out loud, you know, option, so you can click on that, and actually that could be quite good because you hear it reading it out. It's a bit weird, but actually it's quite good now, and it's much better than it used to be. And it'll highlight to you, you'll hear if something sounds wrong, you'll be like, hang on, that sounds a bit, well, I've missed a word there, or there's two words the same next to each other. Stuff that your brain struggles when it's reading to pick up. Because if it's something you've written, your brain will just like read it as it thinks it should be written, not how it's actually written.
Yeah. I want to flip the conversation a little bit here, because it seems like a good spot, because, you know, we just said resume is not supposed to get you the job. But on the flip side, I think too many companies out there look at resumes for the perfect resume. They almost want to hire based on the resume. And how do they get their mindset around that a resume, a CV, should really just be about finding people who are capable of doing the job, and then the interview process and even a person's first 3 to 6 months of employment is determining if somebody can be truly amazing at the job. You're never going to figure that out from a resume, but too many companies do that. How can they shift their mindset to looking for resumes of people who just have potential to be successful?
Yeah, I think having that kind of open mind towards it is really important, because I think sometimes a lot of companies get very set on, I have to find someone who's worked in the same sector for 10 years or whatever it is, and they have, you know, they have to have this much industry experience. But actually, realistically, do they need to have that? Or is it more important that they've got, you know, really good managerial skills, or they're particularly good at like project management or managing change or whatever? actually those sort of skills from a different sector or industry might be far more valuable, because they'll bring in new ideas and different ways of doing things that you maybe haven't thought of. But I think a lot of people do get very stuck in that idea of like, oh no, we have to have like X number of years in a set thing. And obviously for some roles you will need that, but for a lot you don't. So I'd say that they need to be far more open-minded about that side of it, and not be kind of tick-boxy about it. Because I don't know about you guys over there, but for here, like especially for, say, if you want to work for a council, so like a governmental kind of role. I used to work for a council, so I know. I used to sit on interview boards. It's very tick-box-like. So they do it to kind of prevent discrimination and stuff. So it's a kind of a good thing, but also a bad thing. Because it's very much like if you haven't mentioned something, you know, in an interview or on a thing, it's not ticked, and therefore you don't get through. Even if it's obvious you have got that or whatever, if you didn't say it or you didn't put it down in writing, then you know, forget it. Whereas I think they need to be a bit more open-minded about that. They might not have met, you know, someone might not have every single criteria you want, but actually, do they sound like the kind of person that would be a really good fit for your team? Then that's obviously surely a really positive thing, and it's worth talking to them and finding out.
You made a really good point. You know, if they're looking for managerial skills, if they're looking for project management skills, if those are the things that are required to be successful in a job, how much can that actually be conveyed in a resume versus you're only going to find out from talking to that person, from the stories they're able to tell, from talking to people that they've worked with in the past, how much of that can actually be conveyed in a resume?
Yeah, I mean, it is really difficult. Obviously, we can all, and you can say anything you like on a resume at the end of the day, can't you? It's difficult to prove a lot of those things. But like you say, when you talk to someone at an interview, or, you know, even as you see them working, like you pointed out, like the first few months or whatever, you'll soon find out if they have got those leadership qualities that you need. You know, there's going to be inklings you'll get from resumes and stuff, but I think talking to people counts for a lot. And I know I have quite a lot of clients who are kind of struggling with the CV side, but actually they're like, once I get in front of someone, I'll be fine. I can convince anyone that I'm like going to be good enough for the job. But they're just struggling to get that kind of foot in the door bit, especially if they're kind of trying to change industry a bit or, you know, step up. Like they just need someone to give them that opportunity to actually kind of chat to them and stuff and then realize their potential. Because I think when you talk to someone, you get such a feeling about them, don't you, whether they're going to fit in with what you need.
Yeah, it's the challenge is I think that so many ATSs and a lot of hiring authorities and talent acquisition teams, when they're searching for someone for a position, they divide the world up into two categories: absolutely perfect for the job and not right at all. When my philosophy is that it should be the opposite. There are two types of people in the world, but absolutely not right for the job and might be right for the job. And your goal should be to talk to as many of those might be right for the jobs as possible, because that's where you're going to uncover all of the soft skills, all of the hidden talents, all of the vision and the why. You talk so much about a person's why in their book, and that's how you find the people who can really thrive in your organization and help you achieve more than you ever would have thought possible if you're only looking for somebody who has 8 to 10 years of experience in this specific sector with these exact job titles and this specific degree. If that's all you're searching for, then you're only going to get people that have done exactly that, but you're never going to get people that are significantly capable of much more than that.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think people just, they're losing out on amazing candidates by being like that. And that's the bottom line. I mean, I did a poll on LinkedIn the other week about should a salary be on an advert, a job advert. And it was like 93% or something ridiculous like that. Really high percentage of people that said, yes, it should always be on a job advert. And the only people arguing in the comments were recruiters and, you know, maybe people that have employed people before. Like, no, it's not always right. You can't always have a salary on. There's really good reasons not to have a salary on. And you think, but you're not listening to what people want, though, are you, and expect? So you're missing out then on some candidates who won't ever apply to one without a salary or at least some kind of ballpark figure on there or a reason for not having the salary. I said, if you can't have the salary, at least put a reason why. Say, look, we can't discuss the salary for X, Y reasons, whatever. You know, because a lot of them, they will expect the candidate to tell them what their salary expectation is, but won't necessarily be giving anything away themselves, which seems really unfair. And I think it's important to recognize that you need to listen to what people actually want and expect, and sometimes things need to change.
What are some other things that companies can do to really attract the best people out there who do have the most potential to be successful at their company? You talk to people searching for jobs all day. What are they looking for?
Yeah, I mean, I think a lot of people, I deal with quite a lot of neurodiverse people, actually, and I'm quite kind of hot on the inclusion factor of stuff, and I think companies aren't good enough at that yet. I think they're getting there, but I think if they're more open and kind of accepting of people with different like needs and abilities or whatever, I think a lot, you know, especially if you're talking about neurodiverse people, that you can have some, you could end up with some really exceptional people if you just change the way you kind of do things a little bit, or just make it obvious that you're going to be, you know, a bit more flexible with stuff. I think if companies talk about their values a lot more would really help as well, so that people can work out whether they're kind of aligned to what the company stands for, but also actually live that. Like, don't just, you know, write, oh, well, we do this, this, and this, but then actually behind the scenes they're screwing over all the people that work there and they hate it. You know, you have to, that has to be real.
Yeah.
You have to kind of show what you're actually about and mean it.
How do they do that? What are the best ways to go about showing people your values? It's, I mean, we try at our company, but it's a hard thing to do.
It is hard, but I think, I don't know, helping, doing stuff in the community and stuff can be really good. Any kind of like, you know, an advocate for any kind of voluntary type stuff is always really good. I think, you know, good, really good content marketing is a good way of doing it. You know, if you have really real marketing and not kind of just really boring generic stuff, you know, they need to look more at what everyone else is doing. That's where companies need to start going with their marketing and sales anyway, I think. You know, that's what people want to see, and that's what appeals to people in general. It's better for branding if you, you know, if you can appeal in a, on a personal level to people. So by using that kind of style of marketing that maybe some of the smaller businesses do, I think that would work a lot better for some bigger brands. I know it's hard for them to kind of sometimes do that when you're such a big brand. It can be harder to kind of like get it down to a personal level, but there's definitely ways of doing it. I mean, I think if you can, I don't know, use actual employees in your adverts and things like that, you know, that kind of stuff's far more real, isn't it? I
think, are there any companies,
as real as possible.
Are there any companies you can think of off the top of your head that are doing a really good job at it out there?
I don't know.
Sorry to put you on the spot.
I quite like, yeah, that is on the spot. I quite like Pixar's just general ethos and values of the way they do things. Actually, they're quite good. They're quite a good example of that kind of stuff. I mean, I was really impressed with Legoland when I went in England. And there's just the way it's run and the way the staff are and stuff, you can just tell it's a great place to work. And they're really good at like dealing with neurodiversity and stuff, and so that kind of thing is like, it makes it obvious that actually you can see why you'd want to work there, kind of thing. And I think that kind of stuff, you know, especially if you're client facing, like customer facing type of business, you can get a really good feel for it just by, you know, experiencing it, can't you, on the other side of it. Like if you go as a customer, you can get a feel for whether people are happy working there or not.
You've talked about neurodiversity a couple of times here, and I'm sensing that this is something that you're very passionate about. What can companies do to improve their ability to be inclusive of neurodiversity candidates and issues?
I say educate themselves a bit more about it, maybe. I think people are far more open about talking about that stuff now in general, but I think if companies were more open to it, like maybe with their current employees and stuff like that, and actually ask the people who are neurodiverse and ask them what they think and how to do it. Because the same with disabilities. A lot of the time, the people that set up the stuff for it aren't disabled. So actually, they come up with an idea. Like, because my mum's disabled, I hear about and experience this quite a lot. a place will be like, yeah, yeah, we've got a ramp, or yeah, we've set up this like wet room or whatever. But it's obviously never been tested or tried by anyone in a wheelchair or whatever. And it's actually, when it comes to it, it's useless. It doesn't work. The thing, you know, there's not enough space, or the bar's on the wrong side or whatever. Stupid practical issues. And it's the same with neurodiversity, if you ask me. Like, if you ask the people who actually are neurodiverse what they think, and if maybe they're working in your company already, which they probably are, you know, you could even do it in an anonymous way if you don't want to. It's not like, you know, you might have some people that want, are more outspoken. Some people might not want to be outspoken. Ask them what they think, you know, the business could do better, and like, how could this company be better for you, and what, you know, what flexible needs do you have, and, you know, there could be all sorts of things. My daughter's got ASD, you know, she's autism. So for her, like, you know, it might be like, if there's too much noise, if, and there's too much bright lights, and there's too much multicolors everywhere, or whatever, things like that, that maybe, you know, there's not enough quiet spaces in the office, perhaps, you know, having a dedicated area that's always quiet, and people go in there, they have to be quiet and have their phones off or something. That might really help someone who's like struggling, like, you know, gets really overwhelmed with an office situation and can go in, like, have a quiet bit of space or whatever. You know, as an example, but it's the kind of stuff you need to ask the people who need it, rather than just asking, you know, just, I don't know, having like a random boardroom conference about it. You need to ask the people who have those needs in the first place.
Well, it's one of the, I think it's one of the, one of the good things to come out of this past year and a half is a lot of employers are much more flexible in people's working environments, letting people work where they're most able to do the best work. And it doesn't necessarily have to be in a giant cubicle farm surrounded by a bunch of people doing the exact same job as you. So it's, I think it's fantastic that so many companies are listening to their employees about, this is where I do my best work. And the employers are saying, well, if that's where you do your best work, and you've been doing your best work there for the past year and a half, keep it up.
Yeah, absolutely. Remote working is an amazing thing, I think. That suits me, though, because I wouldn't ever want to be in a, like, a busy office ever again. It's just not for me.
I miss parts of it, and we're starting to look at, we're changing our office landscape, and what it's going to look like, we're not sure. I miss seeing our people on a more frequent basis in person, but I also don't mind the ability to focus here alone from time to time.
Yeah,
as well,
there's a balance to be had, for sure, because people can get quite isolated, and that's where you need to listen to what people actually want, I guess.
Yeah.
And rather than just saying, well, everyone has to work at home now, it's like, what?
I want to talk about LinkedIn for a couple of minutes, because I think for job seekers, it's an incredibly underutilized tool. I mean, I know they go on LinkedIn and they apply for jobs on LinkedIn and they connect with recruiters on LinkedIn, but I just feel like there's so much more that people could be doing to really highlight who they are, what their why is, so that they're almost a known commodity. They're a person before they ever apply for a job. What do you think that people should be doing on LinkedIn while they're searching for a job, or even before they start searching for a job?
Yeah, I think personal branding, which sounds like a bit of a cliche now, but I think it's quite important. And I think you can apply that to people who are looking for work just as much as you can if you're running a business. And there's that kind of element of the content you put out and the kind of comments you're making. Like, when you first start, it's quite difficult. Your content's probably not going to get seen by many people. You know, it's a difficult time when you've got a small network and it's not very engaged. But as you build that up, it will get easier. But I always say to people, focus on commenting on other people's stuff more than anything else. So don't get too hung up or stressed out about creating content yourself if you don't want to, or if, you know, if it's difficult. But spend some time commenting on, you know, people, the stuff that's relevant to your industry. You know, give some really valuable comments, or, you know, be yourself and, like, you know, whatever, whether you're funny or whatever, interesting, all these different things. You can share some of your experiences you've had of something. You know, you could use a LinkedIn news story to comment on. I did that once and got like it got featured and then got like 750 likes or something. Wow. And like hundreds of comments. And I got like some clients out of it because it was vaguely relevant to what CVs and stuff, but it was also, you know, obviously people can see from my tagline what I do, and you know, they agreed with what I'd said. So it was like, you know, another time I got featured was about not liking dogs in the office. So, but you know, you could be anything, but it's good to be yourself, you know, and like that will attract the right people to you. Uh-huh. And it doesn't always have to be just about job opportunities anyway, because it's nice to have a supportive network. And you never know then what opportunities may come from that, because someone that you make friends with might not work in your industry, but they might have a friend or a friend that does. And then when they're looking for someone and they ask around, it's like, you know, they think of you. It's that kind of thing. You just want to be the person they think of when it's a job, you know, the job that you want. You want to be the one that they think of. Oh, I know, mm-hmm. a really good project manager, you know, so-and-so, that kind of thing.
And that's, I think that's why it's important to start now. I mean, if you're not active on building your personal brand now, if you wait until you need a job, it's too late. It's going to be too hard. And
yeah, it's a long-term game. You know, it's a long game. You can't, it won't happen overnight.
Mm-hmm. So what can, what's the one thing that people should start doing today to ensure that when they do need to start searching for a job, they're in the best position possible to find the job that is the best job for them? It's a big question.
That's a big question.
It's a really big question.
One thing.
You gotta give the people what they want. They want the tips. They
want
the
Well, trip. I'd be very sure what the job is that you actually do want. Make sure you've got that nailed down. Because like so many times I speak to people about, oh, I need my CV. Oh, can you sort it out? Okay, so what job do you want? Oh, well, I think I'm going to do this. Are you sure though? Are you definitely sure? And, you know, quite a few times I've had conversations with people and then they end up changing their minds. Actually, you're right. I don't really want to do that. I actually don't really like what I'm doing. I want to do something else. So be honest with yourself what your next job is. It doesn't have to follow the linear career path that you had planned out.
Mm-hmm.
Like actually ask that question now and like try and form some kind of plan. You know, it might not be next week you're going to change roles, but it might be like, okay, I'm going to do this for a bit, save some money, in 2 years I'm going to do this. Mm-hmm. But start that process now. Don't wait until you're made redundant and then be like, oh, now's a great time to change career, because that's a really hard time to do it.
Yep. The best time to look for a job is when you don't need to look for a job.
Yeah. And then that's a cliche, but it's true though, isn't it?
Yeah.
People find it so much easier to find a role when they've already got one.
Yep. All right. Well, Rebecca, I'm very excited for your book to come out. Where can people find it when it's available?
Well, it will be on Amazon very soon. And yeah, that's the best way to get it, I think. And obviously follow me on LinkedIn and I'll be rambling on about it constantly. So
we'll make sure to have a link to the book in the down below for people to find it. How to get the kick-ass
Thanks.
Career.
Yeah, if you jump on my website, you can get a free CV template as well. So you not only find out about the book, you get my free template. So.
It's great. And where's the best place for them to find you? Is it your website?
Yes. So either find me on LinkedIn or on my website, which is payforprecision.com. So as long as you can spell precision, you're okay.
We talked about this. We're not good spellers. Rebecca Pay, thank you so much for being with us here today. Really appreciate it. If you enjoyed this show, if you enjoyed the episode, please make sure to rate and review. We'd really appreciate it. And follow us wherever you get your podcasts. Travis Miller, Rebecca Pay, thank you so much. Have a great one, everyone. I'm making a move. On me.